Okay, well, let's begin then. Before we commence, let us all then take a moment to bring our palms together in veneration of the Holy One, the Perfect One, the Matchless One, the Peerless One. He who has compassion, wisdom, kindness, generosity, knows no bounds, and is limitless. Let us remind ourselves how grateful we are and fortunate we are to be his students, to follow in his footsteps, to take instruction from the community of the Sangha that he established, and to be able to fulfill the noble path to ultimate bliss in this very life itself. Let us also regard this as renewing our pledge to ourselves to keep true to the Dhamma and to follow the path, the Noble Eightfold Path, until we have attained the ultimate bliss of Nibbana. So let us take a moment to pay homage. We will then observe the precepts and continue with today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
How are you all feeling today? In high spirits? You look like it. What's up? After all, if the Dhamma can't do that, what good is the Dhamma for, isn't it? If the Dhamma can't help you feel in high spirits, because this is the remedy for all diseases, for all illnesses, for all ailments. This is the panacea. It cures all. Not just the common cold. Cures all. Cures it all. I mean, it cures death. What remedy is there for death other than the Dhamma? Do you know of any? No. There is no other remedy for death. I don't necessarily mean the physical death, because that's not so bad, really. People worry about physical death far too much. It's so overrated. It's not that bad. Why do I say that? Oh, because you've done it so many times. And see, you're here today. It's not so bad. You've been there so many times. Do you remember what it felt like dying last time? Do you? Anyone? Oh, it was so terrible, Swami Nuansa. It hurt so much. I couldn't bear the pain. I don't want to go through that again. Anyone? No, you see, so it wasn't so bad. So you needn't worry about physical death. I'm talking about mental death. The fear of death, the fabrication of death, the notion of death. This is a mental creation, death. Death is not what happens to you when your body gives up on you. Because what was there to die? If all there is a coming together of matter and energy to form a certain construct, they just come together in a certain formation. You watched the birds last week? Yeah, the murmuration. Remember? The birds, they were flying together. They were flying in a certain pattern. And then when one bird, two birds, a few birds started taking a different direction, the others followed. And then whatever you saw on screen, if you saw a dolphin, and what happened to the dolphin? The dolphin decayed and then it died, didn't it? Didn't you see a decaying dolphin? Did you not see a decaying dolphin? Then you saw a decaying tortoise, a decaying flower. You called out various shapes. But did any of that really happen? No. It was just the elements that made up what was on screen, what was up in the sky, right? The real thing. They were the birds just up in the sky. They were just flying in formation. And they were just there. Almost random. They were just there. But they have some kind of instinct that keeps them all together in that particular formation. So they flock together. Excuse me. And they fly together. But those shapes that you saw on screen, the birds had no agenda. So this is a review of what we discussed last week, because I want to take another step forward and help you to really start making sense of the 11 great fires. Because after all, this, the whole reason we talk about dukkha and the Four Noble Truths and all the rest of it is because ultimately you suffer, you feel the pain of the 11 great fires. None of you feel the pain of anything else, really. In fact, you don't feel the pain of jati. You feel the pain of whatever comes after jati. You feel the pain of jara, decay. Don't you? Don't you feel the pain of decay? Ask your grandmother, she'll tell you. The pain of decay. The pain of disease. Disease is not this. Yes, I'm ill, somewhat, getting better now. But that is not the disease that the Buddha speaks of. Because you see, the 11 great fires are all dependent on jati. And jati is a creation of the mind. So if it's a creation of the mind, then disease, as the Buddha refers to it, cannot be the physical disease, can it? Cannot merely be that. That is also in scope, that is also included, but it's not just that. Because even for an arahant falls ill, but there is no suffering. An arahant decays, their body decays, but there is no suffering. And an arahant passes away, and there is no suffering. So as Buddhists, if we fear the same things that non-Buddhists do, then what has the Buddha done for us? What have we got from the Buddha? See, the Dhamma should help you to be strong so that a funeral is just an eventuality for you. You'll be going to many a funeral over the course of your lifetime. Yeah. And including the last one, at which you won't know who will have attended. But you can make all the plans for it. Make all the reservations and ensure that when people arrive, they will be well looked after. You can also ask a catering company to come along and do the catering. You can even get a catering company to organize the rest of the rituals, even weeping at your funeral. Well, it's amazing what people do for a few bucks. They'll cry like your children have never cried. Money can do many things. But one thing money cannot do is to free you from suffering. I wish more people understood that. But people don't understand that. People don't get that. That's why they're all after it. And they think that is the be-all and end-all of everything. Most people, I don't mean everyone, but most people. You know, if there's some money to be had, some money to be gained, a profit to be made, you know how far people are willing to go. You will have been victims of this sometimes. Right? People are so willing to cheat people and take what doesn't belong to them. And, you know, if you could cry, if your tears were money, people will cry you to death. Guru Swami Nuansi taught me that. If you could weep money, people would cry you to death. True, isn't it? Fortunately, when you weep, it's not money that falls out of your eyes. People have got the wrong priorities. Having been born human, they still haven't figured what their priorities are. The fact is, many people have forgotten that it was such a struggle to be born human. This is usually not a topic I bring up in an English audience or to an English audience. You're not English. Are you English? You're not English. It's an English sermon, but you're a Sihela audience, aren't you? Yes. People forget what they were before they became human. And the struggles that they had to make to be born human, the merit that they had to sacrifice, all the deeds that they had to do to acquire enough merits to be born human, this is all forgotten. You know, it only takes one moment to consider how come there are some people who work so hard and they make hardly anything at all, and then there are others who don't have to work as hard, but, you know, they seem to be doing just fine. There has to be something that can explain this phenomenon. So if someone thinks that, you know, there's no such thing called merit and demerit, nothing could be further from the truth. Of course there are merits and demerits. This is the currency that we bring with us and we take with us as we traverse through samsara. It is what helps us to lead a good life. The more merits you have, the better your life will be. The more happy your life will be, the more easy your life will be, the more comfortable your life will be. The reason you have good parents, ladies and gentlemen, is because you have good merits. The reason you have good siblings is because you have good merits. The reason your children are respectable and they are obedient and they listen to you and they don't do anything that brings disgrace and dishonor to the family is all much and large because you have good merits. The people that have come together as your family is because of the merits that you have. Just look at some people and the families that they have to do with, the people that they have to live with. If you're happily married, that's because of your good merits. Not everyone is. I don't think you need me to tell you that. Perhaps you live a happily married life, but what about your sister? Maybe she always gets beaten up and shouted at by her husband. Maybe she's having a terrible time. Maybe her husband's going astray and there's hardly anything she can do about it. She'll come crying about it and she'll come and weep about it and she'll always ask you, Akki, what can I do? Aya, what can I do? But there's nothing you can do about it because on behalf of the children, the family have to stay together. Otherwise, it's the children who end up suffering. Now, they've got no choice. Stuck between a rock and a hard place. What can they do? So if you don't believe in anything else, ladies and gentlemen, at least believe in merits. the power of merits. The very reason that you are hearing what I have to say, tell you today is because of merits. The reason that we have the association of the Mahasangha today is because of merits. The reason that we at least get to see a statue of the Buddha, if not the Buddha himself, is because of merits. At least we can look at that and go, wow, what a great man he must have been. Perfect in figure. How perfect he must have been in conduct. How perfect he must have been in virtue. How perfect he must have been in wisdom. He must have been the epitome of perfection. At least to think like that. Because every time you think about the Buddha, it earns you even more merits. And merits are such a funny thing, because as you reap the rewards of merits, if you're in the right place, you can earn even more merits. Now, for instance, you're here. It is true, if I were to tell you, that as you're listening to these words, as you contemplate on them, right, these words help you to lead a good life, a better life, a wholesome life. So therefore, you're actually paying with your merits to be here. But you needn't fear, because listening to the Dhamma is also meritorious. So you earn as much merits, in fact, more merits while you're here than you spend. But if you're at home just eating something, watching TV, you know, that's also a comfortable lifestyle. Now you're simply consuming merits, because you don't earn any merits by eating food. You don't earn any merits by watching TV. You can't earn merits that way. You only spend merits. But listening to the Dhamma, preaching the Dhamma, these are all hugely meritorious deeds. Attending to your adults and elders, attending to the virtuous ones, these are all meritorious deeds. Charity is such a meritorious deed. There are the 10 meritorious deeds, as you know. So as individuals who are interested in Nibbana, who really want to work on their salvation and achieve that ultimate goal as fast as you possibly can, I urge you, day on day, earn as much merits as you possibly can. Look for those opportunities. There are plenty of them if you just look around you. Plenty of them. Because often people are suffering. No matter where you look, people are suffering, aren't they? So if you can help alleviate someone's suffering, that itself is a merit. Even if you can give someone a meal, that's a meritorious deed, because you're giving a meal to a human being. That's meritorious. It is far more meritorious than feeding an animal. It is. Because a human being has more merit power within them, more merit potential within them. See, there are two factors that contribute to how much merits you can earn from an activity. One is your intention. Two is how pure the receiving party is in terms of their sila, samadhi and prajna. These are the two factors. So when you times the two together, that determines how much merits you can earn from any given meritorious deed. So take giving a meal to someone. In your heart, you have an intention to feed someone. Now this intention can be a pure intention by which all you want is to give something and you want someone to be better out for it. Or you can also have a somewhat defiled intention, which is through what I give, I want them to praise me. I want them to honor me. I want them to recognize that I'm the giving one. Remember that one? I'm the giving one. So then you're looking for credit. So that is slightly defiled. A little bit. Not totally, but a little bit. But what if you're giving someone a meal and you know that this meal, the food that you're going to give them, is not good for them? Maybe you've cooked something and it's not good for them. In fact, if they eat it, something bad's going to happen to them. And you know this. It's going to make them very ill. Now if you give the meal, what do you think is going to happen? Is that meritorious? Why not? Intention. Intention is bad. And then what happens if the receiving party, if that's a dog? Merit or demerit? Of course, demerit. What if it's a human being? Merit or demerit? Demerit, less or more? Even more demeritorious. Why? Because a human being has much more merits, much, much more merits than an animal. And then what if he's a sotapanna person? And then what if it's an anagami person? And then what if it's an arahant? Do you remember Chundasukara? Actually, no, forget Chandrasukara for a second. Do you remember the last meal that the Buddha had? It is said that the Buddha was offered a meal, and that meal was meant to be his last meal. Right? And that meal was not, was so, it had something in it. There's a debate whether that was mushrooms or whether that was some kind of meat. I'm not interested in that debate for the time being. What I'm saying is, there was something in that food that was not good, that would make the Buddha unwell. And the Buddha knew this was to happen. So, as the meal was offered to him, he said, please ensure that nobody else in this gathering takes this food. This can only be consumed by myself. So the Buddha gave that instruction. Because he realized that this is now time for him to pass away, and you know the Buddha is a tremendous amount of energy. So for that energy to disperse, and then for the Buddha to pass into Parinibbana, you need something so strong that can actually, you know, bring that to an end. The Buddha, the Buddha's physique, the Buddha's body. So when the Buddha was offered this meal, the person who was offering it had no intention whatsoever to make the Buddha unwell. But ultimately that is what happened. And then later on he realized that having eaten that meal, the Buddha became unwell. And then you can imagine how shocked he must have been. Just imagine you invite some Swamin Mahanses to your home and you cook something, right? Say you cook some mushrooms, right? But for some people it's a bit allergic, right? Some people are allergic to it. So you offer this food to the Swamin Mahanses, and three of the Swamin Mahanses of, let's say, six monks have arrived. Three of them have now started coughing, and they've got an allergic reaction, right? And now you know that it is because of what you offered them. So how might you feel in that in that moment? It'll be quite shocking, won't it? And you won't be able to forgive yourself, is how you would feel in that moment. So this man, he felt the same. Now this is the Buddha we are speaking of, and he had such devotion towards the Buddha. So he walked up to the Buddha and he started profusely apologizing to him. Venerable sir, I had no idea that this was going to happen. You know, I feel that I have done something so sinful, something so terrible. You know, how am I ever going to pay for what I've done? And the Buddha said, fear not. You had no intention whatsoever to harm me or hurt me or make me unwell or ill. So you have not earned any demerit. In fact, you have earned as much merits as the first meal that was offered to me when I became the Buddha. So the amount of merits you've earned is no less than the first meal that was offered to me. How was that so? Because of intention, absolutely. And on the receiving party, we have the Buddha. So these two factors combined, intention and the purity of the receiving party, these two factors combined determines how much merits you earn out of a meritorious deed. Now, of course, you live among human beings in an era that the Buddha's Dhamma still prevails. right? To be born in this era in itself is a tremendously meritorious deed. You have to be tremendously meritorious just to be born in this era, and therefore, as you live in and amongst your family, your friends, right? Look for every opportunity to earn as much merits as you possibly can, because these merits will help you on your path to salvation. After all, Nibbana is being freed from suffering. So in whatever capacity you are able to help others free themselves from suffering, what you give is what you get. Even if it is offering someone a glass of water. Even if it is, you know, sweeping the premises. If you ever find yourself at a temple, at the monastery, and you have some spare time, right, and you can see a broom somewhere and it seems like, you know, it hasn't been swept recently, you can pick up the broom, pick up a nakal broom and start sweeping. This will earn you merits. In those moments you mustn't feel, oh, you know, what will people think? I don't think any of you would do that, but it might occur to some people, you know, what would people think? Am I too posh for this? You must never be too posh for merits. I don't think any of you are like that, but I have seen some people like that. They are too posh to do merits. Unfortunately, in thinking so, they don't do enough merits, and then all that happens is they just keep on expending their merits, keep on expending their merits, and then one day comes where there's no longer any more merits to keep them happy, to keep them comfortable. And then suffering is all that's left to happen. So bear that in mind. Wherever you get the chance, earn as much merits as you possibly can. While your parents are still alive, that's a fountain of merits. Do make use of them. And you can, you know, your parents are very special to you. I've said this many times before and I'll keep telling it many times again and again and again, because there's no point me telling this to you after your parents are gone, is there? Like, this is only worthwhile while I tell this to you while your parents are still alive and they're with you, right? So, you know, there are young people in this audience who are fortunate enough to still have their parents with them. Do the best you can for them. Go over and above. Go the extra mile for your parents. Never have a moment's hesitation about that. You will not regret. Because they're very special. Very special to you. They're not very special to anybody else. This is the Buddha's teaching. Because he doesn't make speculations. He doesn't. He says it because it is so. He doesn't guess. He doesn't estimate. The Buddha, although he's a scientist, he doesn't follow the scientific method. That's something that is unusual about this scientist. With the scientific method, you test, you collect your results, you analyze, you come to a conclusion, yeah? And then you, with that conclusion, you start with a hypothesis. Then you do some experiments, you collect your test results, you do some analysis and you come to a conclusion. And then that conclusion can always be tested later on. And when new information comes to light, perhaps that conclusion might deem to be false, and then a new hypothesis will be developed. And then through there, again, experimentation and so on. So that's the way science works out there. But the Buddha, although he was a scientist, he doesn't follow the scientific method. Because his science, or the way that he discovers things, is by having a pure mind. So his mind is free of all defilements. He has he has limitless wisdom. So therefore, when the Buddha wants to know something, he just has to think about it. And what comes to his mind is the truth. Now, this sounds unbelievable, isn't it? That's because you and I are not Buddhas. So the Buddha does not experiment. So he doesn't do an experiment to come up with the Four Noble Truths. He doesn't do an experiment to figure out anicca, dukkha and anatta. These are his perfections. His perfections have perfected him so that once he is perfect, whatever comes to his mind is perfect. Therefore, whatever the Buddha has taught us can never be proven to be wrong. It can never be. 2,500 years has passed since his becoming a Buddha, and to this day, ladies and gentlemen, not one thing that he has said has been proven to be wrong. He said, attachment is the cause of suffering. Can you prove me that it is something else? Attachment is the cause of suffering. No one else said that. But can you prove it to me that it is something else? It is not attachment, but something else instead? It's not. Anything that the Buddha has said, because his knowledge is perfect, because he is perfect, his mind is perfect, free of all defilements, he has what is called the Sarvajnacha Jnana. He is the omniscient one. He knows it all. It's not like the Buddha's mind is always full of knowledge. Whenever he wishes to think about something, whenever he focuses on something, it's only the truth that comes to him. Whereas for us, you know, we have various ideas, so then we have to balance them out, we have to test them, we have to verify them, right? We have to calculate them and see, you know, whether it agrees with previous experience, whether it agrees with our existing body of knowledge. Whereas for the Buddha, that is not so. So 84,000 Dharma skandhas he has taught, that is all contained in the Tripitaka. And not a single syllable of that has been proven to be wrong. And that is not because people aren't trying. People are trying. People are trying to show that even the Buddha was flawed. There were faults in his thinking. There were weaknesses in his thinking. And to this day, they haven't been successful. And by the Buddha's own invitation, he says, do try and prove this wrong, because the more you try and do that, the more you realize this is the truth. That's one of the best ways to prove that something is right, isn't it? To try and prove it wrong. Because the more you try and do it, the more you realize it is the undeniable truth. In fact, we use that strategy at the monastery. So when we are first teaching our young anagarikas and our monks the Dhamma, so once we've taught them a few things, then we tell them to fend the Dhamma, and we start to try and prove to them that the Dhamma is wrong. So someone says anicca, I say, no, it's not anicca, it's nitya. Then someone says, attachment is the cause of suffering. So they start speaking, and then we say, no, attachment is not the cause of suffering. How is attachment the cause of suffering? I'm not attached to anything, but I'm still suffering. It's not attachment. A disease is the cause of suffering, or decay is the cause of suffering. Illness is the cause of suffering. Not having what I want is the cause of suffering, whatever. You know, we just bring up various theories, and then we try to prove to them that the Dhamma is wrong. But then they have to fend it. And those who have really understood the gist of it and gotten the real essence of the Dhamma, they'll always come back and prove to us that we are wrong. So we use that at the monastery. And it works. It works wonderfully. Sometimes when parents come and they bring in their children with them, and some wish to hand over their children to go on to become anagarikas, sometimes the parents, they do it very willingly and they know that that is what is best for their children, but sometimes the grandparents, they don't. So the parents, they leave the children with us, but the grandparents, they'll come back. And so the parents, they come and ask us for help. They say, Swami Nahansa, please, can you do something with the children so that when my mother and father come, they're not going to fail the test. So the parents come and ask us to prepare the children for the ultimate test. D-Day. So then what we do is, we teach the children how to face off these questions. from the grandparents. And unless the grandparents come and speak irrationally, and if they speak irrationally, then there's nothing you can do, right? You can't have an argument with someone, you can't have a discussion with someone who doesn't speak rationally. So if they actually start speaking logic, right? Why are you here, Buddha? You know, why can't we be happy? You know, I'll get you a new bike, I'll get you a new computer game, I'll get you a new bat and ball. Like, why don't you come home? Let's go home. You know, I'm sure we can be happy. And then the child begins to speak to the grandmother, and he convinces her, or we train them to convince the grandmother that no, those things don't make me happy. In fact, the reason that Achyamma is asking me to come home is because Achyamma has still haven't figured out how to be happy without me. So Achyamma's happiness is still dependent on something or somebody else. So the child is taught to teach the grandmother how to find unconditional happiness. But then there are some grandmothers that will come and say, you know what, shut up, come home with me. I'm your Achyamma, don't speak a word, let's go. That's irrational. You can't argue with that. So unless you use dirty tactics or guerrilla tactics like that, there's always the truth always rises to the top. You can't deny the truth. The truth is the truth is the truth. But even when the children are with us, we always tell them to earn merits. Do as many merits as you possibly can, because if you don't have enough merits, then one of those days Achyamma is going to come and pull you by your ear and say, come, let's go home. And then there's not a force in the world that can stop them. We can't stop parents from taking their children home, because the children don't belong to us. The children belong to their parents. After the age of 18, of course, children they're free to do whatever they want. That is, by law, they're free to do that. But at the monastery, the children are only with us for as long as the parents want to keep them with us. That's the way it is. That's why until the age of 18, we don't ordain anyone. So they still remain as lay children, but we refer to them as anagarikas, you know, no different. And they learn, they educate themselves, we teach them. So they don't live as monks, but they live a holy life nonetheless. They don't do any unmeritorious deeds. There are plenty of opportunities to do meritorious deeds, to help others and to learn the Dhamma, and to develop discipline and virtue, all the good things that we don't get a lot these days out there. Hardly, you know, schools hardly teach these things, because, I mean, you can't blame the schools for that, because the schools are really nowadays institutions that have to prepare children to face the challenges of the 21st century. And there are far too many things to learn nowadays, aren't there? Because, you know, as science advances, you know, the knowledge pool, the human knowledge pool just keeps on growing, doesn't it? So, you know, maybe 100 years ago, do you remember they used to print the encyclopedia? Encyclopedia they used to come in print form many years ago. These days, they've given up. I don't think they even do a print edition of it anymore, because there's far too much knowledge to actually publish it in print form. If you had to publish all of the knowledge that human beings have discovered in print form, excuse me, you'd have to fill your whole house with it. You wouldn't be able to compile it into a few volumes. So there's far too much knowledge for people to acquire in a lifetime, that there isn't now enough time to speak to people and to educate them about values and virtues and how to be a good citizen, how to be respectful towards your adults, how to be courteous, how to be generous. These things have very little place now. So that is what we try and focus on our children at the monastery. But of course, we always engage them and encourage them to earn as much merits as they possibly can. So anyhow, what I want you to do is, while you're here meaning not just here in this human planet, earn as much merits as you possibly can Don't miss any opportunity. Be intelligent in the way you earn your merits. So it's not wise to be foolish. Of course, it's not wise to be foolish. Does it make sense? What I mean by that is, you know, if there's someone knocking on your door and asking you for some food, it's one thing to offer him something that you might have at home, but it's another to invite a completely random person into your home and bring them into your living room and sit them down and give them a 5-course meal. By the time you're gone to the kitchen and come back, the TV will be gone as well. So you've got to be intelligent in the way you earn your merits. Otherwise, your demerits will also come through the door along with your merits. So please be intelligent in the way you do your merits, but that shouldn't be a hindrance to your merits. Be wise, be tactful, be strategic, but do earn as much merits as you possibly can. It's the only thing that will be left. I have a question for you. I had a conversation with someone recently and an example that came up. Say there were two people, ladies and gentlemen. One had a dollar, another had $1 million. Okay? These two people, the man with a dollar, they're both nearing the end of their lives. Okay? Two people. One has a dollar, the other has $1 million. The first guy, he spends his dollar and he buys a chocolate. Okay? And this chocolate he gives to a beggar. So this is the last offering that he's going to get to make. And he really rejoices in that. He sees how the poor man tears open the bar of chocolate and he maybe breaks half of it and gives it to his child and then eats the other half. And then with so much joy and gratefulness, you know, he says, "Thank you so much, sir. I was so hungry. Thanks to you today, you know, I'm able to actually, this is the only breakfast I got, so thank you so much." And then this man who's just gave the chocolate says, "I wish I had more with me. If I did, I would give it to you, but this is all I have." And that's it. That's the end of that story. The other guy, he has $1 million. But he's a miser. He doesn't like to give. With that $1 million that he has in the bank, he dies. These two people, they're born again. Which one do you think took with them the money that they had? The first one. Why is that? Yes, because they converted the money that they had to a currency that they can take with them to the afterlife. The $1 million that the other man had, he didn't convert it to a currency that he could take with him when he was going to go. So it remained in his bank account. So it's not what you save that you take with you. It's what you invest. If you want a return, invest. You know, you've worked so hard, haven't you? All your lives. Now, of course, I don't know how much you have in your bank accounts. I don't need to know either. So don't come and tell me how much you have. But you know how much you have in your bank accounts, and you know that none of it was, you know, money that grew on trees. Am I right? Right? Whatever you've managed to earn so far in your lives, ladies and gentlemen, whether it's the money in your bank account, whether it's the property that you've owned, that you've managed to purchase for yourselves, right? The land, the estates, the buildings, whatever, your business, right? Whatever you've managed to build up from scratch, maybe with little help from your parents, but for some of you, maybe with no help at all. You built it all from scratch. Yeah? And you're proud about that. Yes, good. But you know that you shed blood, sweat and tears on behalf of that. Time that you could have spent with your wife, time you could have spent with your husband, time you could have spent with your children, you spent trying to build up the business, trying to earn that money. All the harsh criticisms that you had to listen to, all the foul mouthing that you had to endure to earn all that, You know the stories behind every dollar, every cent, every rupee in your accounts. You know the stories behind each and every one of them. What a pity it would be if we'd have to leave all that behind. Think about this. If you don't invest it, you're not going to be able to take any returns from it. Because to get, you have to give. And that's why we give it to the bank, Swami Mahansa. When you give it to the bank, if you give it out of charity, yes, then you can take it with you. You go to the bank manager and you tell the bank manager, I can see what a tremendous service you are doing to the whole country. Right? Here's a $1 million check, right? Keep it. Then you're giving it out of charity, you're giving generously, right? Then there's intention of giving with nothing expected in return. Fair enough, you can take that with you. But usually, you know, when people, they just keep stuffing their accounts, as I once used to do, keep stuffing my accounts with stuff, and so that every morning I'd wake up and check how many zeros I had at the end of the I had at the end of the bank account balance. I took great delight in that until I realized that I'm not going to be able to take any of this with me if I don't start giving. So towards the end of my lay life, I remember, I realized, you know, this is the last time I'm going to spend the things I've earned. I'm never going to be earning anymore. It's certainly not money in this way. So everything I had, I started spending. Not spending, but rather investing. And it is because of all that investments today we have, partly, not just myself, but everyone who got together at the time. We have a monastery on which we have built this wonderful place where people can come and find solace. Guru Swami Mahansa, when he was a lay person himself, and many other people who are really enthusiastic about starting up the monastery back then. I remember, you know, I used to live a reasonably good life. But when it was time and I realized that you should start saving every single penny as much as you possibly can, then I used to start going out, not going out, but we used to start going to the supermarkets nearer the time they were going to shut. Because what they have is then they have items that are going to expire, they put them on discount. If you've gone to the supermarkets nearing the time they're about to close, you know what I mean. Right? They put on half price and 20% off, 60% off, 80% off. Right? So those things. And then you used to buy value stuff. So whereas you used to buy the premium products initially, towards the end of my lay life, we transferred to buying the value stuff. So Tesco values. So a pack of biscuits, which used to cost us maybe £10, I used to get it for 50 pence. Because after all, you know, what you eat comes out of you in 6 hours' time. So why does it matter how expensive the stuff that goes in is? But actually, if you can save that up so that you can invest it in something greater than you, greater than yourself, if you can save that and invest it in something that can bring much goodness and greatness to many more people than just yourself, you know, and that is a real investment. And that is the only thing I can actually take with me when I'm gone. So this is just an invitation to you. Right? This is not a strict rule or law I'm laying down on any one of you. I'm just saying this is an invitation on you. Whatever money you've earned so hard, right, you've worked so hard to earn it, whatever property you have, do realize, ladies and gentlemen, you work so hard for this, just do something so that you can take it with you when you go. If you just leave it in an account somewhere, it's not going to go with you. When you're gone, someone else will come and put their name next to it and then they'll just start using it because it hasn't been converted to merits. Merits is the only thing you can take with you when you go. Your merits and your demerits. But what you give, it earns you merits. I say this to you because I know how hard it must be to earn. How hard it is, because I've earned in my life, so I know how hard it is. And if you worked your socks off, earning every penny that you have, then do something so that you can take it with you when you go. Otherwise, it will just be there in an account somewhere, and that will be it. You won't have used it, because it's just piling up in an account. At least if you use it, then you've made some use of it, right? At least if you've eaten by spending it, or lived a luxurious life by spending it, then so be it. But you know, if it's just piling up in an account, you've not made use of it at all. So, if I was still a lay person, I mean, what I tell my parents is, now, Amma, there's nothing you need to give me when you're gone. So whatever you were intending on giving me, if you were intending on giving me anything when it was time and you felt that it was, you know, that was part of my inheritance from you, when you know it's time, it's getting nearer the end, invest it in a way that you can take it so that it's with you when you're gone. Invest it. Invest it in what? Stocks and shares. Invest it in the best place that you can. Remember, there are two factors: your intention and the purity of the receiving party. These two together determine how much merits you can earn. If you give the same meal to a Sotapanna person as you would give to an Anagami person, you earn merits by giving to the second. You earn more merits by giving to the second, because an Anagami person is more pure in their mindset. Because what makes you pure is how free, how pure your mind is from the defilements. Vitaraga, vitadosa, vitamoha. I'll explain to you why that is so. Why it is that the more pure the receiving party is, the more merits you get out of it. I'll explain that in just a moment. But first, I want you to understand this principle. Your intention must be there, of course. So the intention must be pure itself. Right? You give with no expectation in return. The more you expect, the more impure your intentions are. The more you expect. So if you expect, like I said, honor or praise, right? Or maybe a reward, anything of that sort, or maybe to get into their good books, right? If those, madam? Yes, absolutely, wonderful. If the intention is for nirvana, that is as pure can be, right? That is the purest of intentions, nirvana. Because if one has the intention to do something for nirvana, as I said, remember last week, nirvana is not anybody's nirvana. It's not your nirvana, my nirvana, nirvana is nirvana. Nirvana is freedom from all defilements, freedom from suffering. Right? So if the intention is pure, so again, see, purity of the receiving party is how much or how little there is raga, desha and moha. Yeah? That is what determines the purity of the receiving party. Raga, desha and moha, desire, aversion and delusion. This is in the Pali. What about the intention? Same. Raga, desha and moha. So don't you see how universally purity is defined? Universally, the extent to which the mind is free of raga, desha and moha, that is what determines how pure a mind is, how pure a source is. Raga, desha, moha, where there is no raga, desha, moha, we call it vitaraga, vitadosa, vitamoha. That is why the Buddha is one of the best recipients, the perfect recipient of all offerings, because there is absolutely no raga, no dvesha, and no moha. An arahant is also the same. But in the Buddha's, the way a Buddha differs to an arahant is, in addition to there being no raga, dvesha, moha, there is something called infinite compassion. There is infinite wisdom. You know, there are so many other qualities and virtues which an arahant can never in their lifetime instill within themselves. So that is how great, how good, how benevolent they are to mankind, to all sentient beings. So the degree to which the mind is free of raga, dvesha, moha is what determines whether something is pure or not. Okay, so pure of intention and pure of the receiving party. So this is the recipient, this is the donor. So if you're the donor, then your mind, the extent to which your mind has as its object something that is vita raga, vita dosa, vita moha. In other words, free of desire, aversion and delusion, to that extent this intention is pure. So as the good lady asked, what about if it's Nibbana? What is Nibbana after all? Ragakya, dveshakya, mohakya, isn't it? A state where there is zero raga, zero dvesha and zero moha. That state itself is Nibbana. So if that becomes your intention, then there is no greater intention. There cannot be a greater intention.
So when the purity of the recipient, how does one ascertain?
Very good question. That is the toughest thing to do. So you can't do that, unfortunately. Now you see, that we have to leave to merits itself. That itself we have to leave to merits. Now, I'll come to that in a moment, okay? Purity of the recipient, raga, dvesha, moha, and how more or less they have it determines their purity. So, as the lady asks the question, so how do we determine, how do we ascertain who is the most suitable for this offering? Let's say there are two monks. Which one has less raga, which less dvesha and less moha? How do you decide which one to offer it to? How can you tell by looking at them? Is it the younger monk? Is it the one who looks more mature? Is it the older one? Because of course he's been in the sasana for longer. Is it the one with the torn robe? Because they seem to be more more simple. Is it the one with the daskara, chivara? Is it the one that doesn't wear slippers? Because they are more virtuous. How do you ascertain? You can't. You can't tell. Of course you can't tell. That you're going to have to leave to chance. So then when you invite Swami Nohanses around, say to give an alms at home, how do you know if the Swami Nohanses is holy? How do you know if they're virtuous? How do you know if they're good? How do you know if, you know, just before leaving the temple, coming and arriving at your home, maybe they were playing Omi? How do you know? Or maybe they were in a deep state of meditation. How do you know? You can't tell that, can you? No. So that is not for us to determine. So this part, there's little we can do. That is why the Buddha teaches us as monks to always work on ourselves, so that when a devotee makes an offering, from our side, we elevate it as much as we possibly can, so that you earn as much merit as you possibly can. So from our side, this is a duty that the Buddha has given us. We have to work on ourselves so that we are free of defilements. We continue, we work on ourselves, we cleanse our minds of our defilements, and purify ourselves so that when you make such offerings, the merits that you earn as a result of that are magnified, are amplified. Now, the question I want to come to is, why is it then that the less there is raga, dvesha and moha, it is better? Why does this formula work? This is a question I want to help you find an answer to. In other words, why is it so that when you make an offering and that offering is received by someone who has less raga, dvesha and moha, why does it give you more merits as a result of that? Less defilements, but so? Let me explain to you now. You can now start to make sense of this because of the things we've been talking about lately. Remember, I've been asking you who you are and what is this self that you sense inside of you? And you're beginning to understand the self is just a perception, right? And you are not an actual self, but this is just a perception. When you feel that you are an actual self, ignore the fact that this is just a perception. Going back to before you started listening to the Dhamma talks, right? You were well and truly a self. I am a self, myself, right? So when you are a self, ladies and gentlemen, your number one objective becomes self-preservation. That is your primary objective, self-preservation. So you start with me and then my family, my friends, my country, my world, my universe. You know, it all expands from there, but it is all centered on self, right? So it starts with my children and so on. That's why you always feel kinder towards your own people than you feel towards others. It's natural. I'm not blaming anyone for that. It's very natural. Whereas for as long as you feel a self, you can't help that. It's just the way it is. So then what happens if someone gives something to you? Let's take work as that's a good example. At work, they give you a bonus at the end of the year. What? You're like, as if, sorry, nonsense. So let's say at work they give you a bonus at the end of the year, okay? Imagine, just imagine, can you? They give you a bonus at the end of the year. With this money, now you want to do something. Okay? Now, when you want to do something with this money, or say even if you won the lottery, when you want to do something with this money, who comes to mind first? Of course. Your circle of your own people. So, this bonus that has come to you, this added advantage, right? So the universe has given you something, right? So of course it's the boss. For some people the boss is the whole universe, but I mean the universe has just given you something, right? And you want to direct that bonus towards your own people, right? And if something's left over, then you might give it to maybe someone just outside of that circle. So, you know, your circles may be something like this. So there's me. Then around that you have my family. Around that you have, who do you have? Friends? Okay. Then maybe work colleagues? Neighbors, okay. Then you can have maybe my village folk, right? Then you have my fellow countrymen, yeah? So you keep going outward that way, But it's all centered on me. Okay? So, when something good comes your way, whether that is some money or some other kind of advantage, some other kind of benefit comes to you, you always start thinking outwards this way. But first it has to benefit you and your own people. So this is you, this is your family. This can be your friends. Maybe your extended family, that sort of thing. But what about whereas you begin to practice the Dhamma and your mind gets free from raga, desha and moha and you stop thinking about the self because you realize that the self is just a perception and then the self that you've been experiencing, the self that you've been perceiving all this time, you know, simply starts to fade away. Now you don't feel that, you don't feel this way anymore. You feel like this. That's all you feel. That's everyone. Now you are a global citizen. You belong to everybody. And everybody belongs to you. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam is a Sanskrit phrase that means the whole world is my children. Everyone is my child. When you feel that you are a self, then your children, your own children, are more important to you than somebody else's child. So therefore, if you have a benefit, if you have some kind of benefit that you've earned, you've gained, your response would be to help them get something out of that first before others would get the leftovers. This is a very natural reaction. But then as you work on Nibbana, raga, desha and moha start to fade away, and you become free of this sense and perception of self, now you become part of everything. You become nature. You belong to everyone. And everyone belongs to you. So you lose this sense of ownership. Because you lose the sense of identity. You are everyone. So now, when something comes your way, some bonus, some advantage, some benefit comes your way, who do you want to give it to? Just a small portion of people? Your own circle of people? Or to everyone? Everyone. Just think of the sky for a second. The sky takes up all the water from the oceans, right? As the sun shines bright, it evaporates the water, and the sky absorbs all that water and forms clouds. And then what the sky does is it gives that water back to all. It doesn't do it to just a small pool or a population of people. It just gives it to all. It does not pick and choose. It does not discriminate. Because the sky belongs to everyone. To the sky, it doesn't matter whether you're black or white. It doesn't matter who's who you are. It doesn't matter what your ancestry is. It doesn't matter whether you like the sky or not. It doesn't matter. Because to the sky, you are just another citizen. So do you see, when you give to someone who is free of raga, desha and moha, because they don't have a sense of self, they don't have a sense of who that whatever you have been given to or whatever you have given to must go to first. Now this is not to say that they don't understand, you know, who needs it most. Of course they understand. Now, for example, If you give someone a Panadol card, a paracetamol card, or maybe a box of paracetamols, right? And there were 10 people in the room, you don't just give it out to everybody. You ask them who's got a headache, and then you give it to them, right? But say there were two individuals, one's got a headache, the other, and so has the other, but one is related to you and the other isn't. you feel inclined to give it to the person that you are related to because you have a special bond with them. You have a special connection to them. These connections, therefore, mean that sometimes it's not always the person who deserves it most gets it. It's not always those who deserve it get it first because of your bias towards them. So there's a bias that every ignorant and attaching mind has. There's always a bias. And I'm sure you will have experiences, right? Even your own two children, if you feel closer towards one than the other, then there'll be a bias. And sometimes you might treat one just a little bit better than you might treat another child. Sometimes your children pick up on that. It's possible. These biases, and sometimes they change. Like this month it's one way, then and next month it's another way. Maybe one gave you a birthday card, the other one forgot. So these things can happen. You know, innocent things, but those biases can take place. But you see, an arahant has no bias. All they see is necessity. So where they see necessity, they address that. So this is why when you receive something and then you give it to someone, the receiving party, if they have very little raga, desha and moha, whatever you give them, they use it to serve everyone. But the more raga, desha and moha they have, whatever you give, they would use it to serve the people who are close to them, to a small population of people, to a small selection of people. That's the way it works. Now, think about it for a second. When you pay your taxes, right? When you pay your taxes, the state uses that money to serve the whole nation. So everyone in the country makes use of that. But if you give some money to a beggar on the street, he's probably going to go and use that money to feed himself and his family. So I'm not saying you shouldn't be giving any money out to anyone. That's not what I'm saying. But what I'm trying to prove to you is the point that when you give to someone who cares about the masses, more good comes out of it because it is used to serve the masses. Whereas if you give something to someone who cares about a very small selection, a very small pool of people or things, then whatever you contribute goes into only serving that small population. This is the way it is. So this is why the amount of merits that you earn as a result changes. So as you give to someone or to an organization or an institution or say the Buddha Sasana, so as the Buddha Sasana is compassionate towards all. Yeah? So therefore, if you give something to the Buddha Sasana, and I don't mean the Buddha Sasana ministry, so you got to take this the way I intend to, right? Now, there may be certain places where whatever you give, maybe they're only interested in building up their own places and maybe not doing good for the masses. Maybe there are, maybe there aren't. I don't know. I'm just saying. Okay? So, as I said, whenever you do your merits, you've got to be intelligent how you do them. So, don't just go spending willy-nilly. That's not what we need to do. You've got to be very intelligent as we do this because this is all hard-earned stuff. It's your hard-earned money. So, when you give to someone, do try your best to give to someone who will make use of it to benefit the masses. As many as possible, regardless of race, religion, age, whatever. If you can do that way, then many more people will benefit out of that. So this is where, as I said, you have your intention and purity of the receiving party. Purity of the receiving party, therefore, is what I meant by that. So, as the receiving party is purer and less raga, desha and moha, their intention then will be to serve the masses, to serve as many human beings as possible. Not just Muslims, not just Buddhists, not just Hindus, not just women, not just men. It's good, I mean, even if someone's using it to serve, say, children, and all they're focused on is children. That's also good, but that's a small population of people, so they serve children. And then if you give someone, maybe you give to the church, good. So perhaps, you know, a particular church, you know, they use it to serve people of that faith. That's good. There's nothing bad about that. But what you need to understand is, then it goes into a small pool. So it's a small population of people who benefit out of that. If maybe you give to a temple, a Buddhist temple, and maybe the Swaminarayan Sadhguru is only interested in building up his own temple and not using it for the service of mankind, right? Then again, it's good. You're building a temple. Yes, it's meritorious. There'll be a big stupa by the end of the year because of your donations. Yeah, that's good. But you need to be aware that that is what's going on. But if you really want to give to the masses, then think of the Buddha Sasana. Because the Buddha Sasana is not a temple. The Buddha Sasana is not a monk. The Buddha Sasana is no one in particular. The Buddha Sasana is Nibbana for all. That is what the Buddha Sasana is. So then don't come asking me, where is the Buddha Sasana? Don't come asking me where the Buddha Sasana is. The Buddha Sasana is where the Buddha Sasana is. So I'm not here to lay down guidelines for you to make your investments. I'm not an investment manager. All I want to do is to help you understand that it is only what you invest you can take with you. That, at least you agree with me? Remember the dollar? That dollar was the only dollar that got taken with them. $1 million, that was in the bank, that remained in the bank. They couldn't take that with them. I do know that you work really hard to earn and to have earned all the money that you have and all the property and the wealth that you have built up over the last however many years of your lives, making many sacrifices. Invest it so that you can take it with you when you go. But that's a personal choice that you have to make. All I can do is show you the facts. I was glad that when I was nearing the end of my lay life, I received this instruction. So I knew what to do when I was there, and it's my duty to share with you what I think is right. But you have to decide what you want to do for yourselves. So the lady asks, with this equation, won't the really needy and poor, yes madam? Yeah, get excluded. What do you think? Looks like they will, won't they? Why are the needy needy and why are the poor poor? Here's what I suggest you do. Teach this principle to the needy and the poor. So that they don't have to remain needy and poor. If you help a poor person, now, you know, random guy you meet on the street, you're not going to get a chance to do this. But let's say you have a distant cousin in the family. You know, they're really finding it difficult to make ends meet. But you feel that it's partly your duty to help them, you know, you feel for the family and you want to do something for them, right? So out of your generosity, you talk to the guy and you say, Malli, I'm going to help you out with this, right? Let's start you up. I'm going to help you up so that you can build yourselves up, right, over the next few years. You don't always have to suffer like this. You look at your children, you know, they don't get themselves a good education either. So I'm going to help you. But I want you to adopt this principle. So, no matter what you have, give some of that to a cause that cares about the masses. And in doing so, ladies and gentlemen, you don't just give them, you don't just catch them fish, you teach them how to catch fish. So, if you give them something, that will be enough for today. They'll survive today. But if you teach them this principle, then what you're giving them is the knowledge, is the wisdom to generate for themselves enough for today, tomorrow, and forever. Although this is the truth, not many people will learn this. Certainly not in this lifetime, certainly not in many lifetimes. Because these truths are very rare. They don't come around every so often. So, in this audience, today we've discussed this. How many people will actually do this? Very few. How many people will never actually come across this? Many. The majority will not even know about this. So, they will all, you know, the poor and needy will, of course, you know, they will always get. Now, whenever you have something spare, right, you need to give to the poor and needy as well, because you know they need your charity, of course. I'm not saying every penny towards an investment of the sasana. That's not what I'm suggesting. This is simply a principle for you to bear in mind, and you do your own checks and balances. So you do your own accounts, right? If you want to do 5% this way, 95%, however you've always been doing, then that's up to you. Because of course you'll have family duties that you have to fulfill towards them, right? You maybe have your, as I said, you have a brother who's finding it difficult to make ends meet, and you have to help them, you have to support them. That's also part of it. You know, your brother is not in the sasana, but you have to help them. That's part of your family, your filial duties. Then you have your taxes to pay. You have, you know, if you live in your community, there may be community projects going on, and you have to contribute towards that as well, right? And then if there's at the workplace, if there's a hat collection, you have to contribute towards that as well, right? Because that's all part of being a citizen wherever you are. You have to play the role. This is just a principle for you to bear in mind and apply it where you see it fit. It may not work everywhere. I mean, the principle is a principle. It's true. It is true wherever. But you may not be able to apply this everywhere. That I understand. So wherever you can, at least now you know this. So where you see the needy and the poor, of course you give them, but if you can, give them a little bit of Dhamma as well. This is also Dhamma. Help them to become, try and help them come out of being needy. Try and help them to come out of being poor. That is not by giving them as much as they need financially. But if you can help them to come out of a poor mindset, because a poor man is poor not because he has little money. A poor man is poor because of a poor mindset. Because he has a deserving mindset, not a contributing mindset. He feels that people should always give him. Therefore he's always poor. If he feels that society must look after him. He feels that, you know, those who have must give us. So they're always poor. So they don't feel the need to labor. They don't feel the need to... By the way, you know, these are not stereotypical remarks about anyone. So please don't be offended by anything I say. I'm just saying, you know, typically this is what happens, right? When someone has a poor mindset, they'll always remain poor no matter how much money they earn. Even if you go to the bank and write a check out for every cent you have to a poor person who has a poor mindset, right? And now you're bankrupt, and that man, he's got a fortune to his name. In 6 months' time, he'll be back to nothing because he has a poor mindset. Because you, so therefore, you know, like with children. Someone asked me the other day, Swaminarayan sir, should I be giving my children money? I've earned money in my life. Should I be giving it to them? Or should I be donating it to a worthy cause? I said, sir, it's not for me to answer that question for you, but I can tell you this. If you give your children money, it's good so that they can have a good start, but teach them not just that this is money, but teach them the value of it, so that as they grow up, they will learn a rich man's mindset. Teach them a rich man's mindset, so that they will not always keep coming back to you and asking for more. If you've given them a head start, then that should be enough to get them going from there on. So once you've given them, once you've given them a head start, then from there on, they need to learn for themselves, just as you did for yourselves, right? Maybe, as I said, your parents might not have been able to give you anything when you first started out. Maybe they were able to give you something, maybe they weren't able to give you anything. You started from scratch, right? But you learned it on the go, you learned it living life, and you learned how to build up for yourselves. If you can teach your children not to be dependent on you, but build up for themselves, then what you have given them will be a blessing. But if you simply give them something and tell them, when it runs out, come back to me and I'll give you a little bit more, now you are creating there a vortex. It's almost like a black hole. No matter how much you keep throwing at it, it'll just disappear. And then they'll come back and keep asking for more. And then you give some more and they'll come back again. And give some more and they'll come back again. Because what you haven't learned, taught them is how they can have a contributing mindset. It's very dangerous to actually create in our children a deserving mindset. If anyone believes that they deserve, people deserve to, I deserve to receive from people, I mean, that's a poor man. They can never rise up above their level. They'll always be at the same level every day because they'll always be there expecting others to look after them. We mustn't be like that. So, do we give to the poor and needy? Yes, of course. Of course we give to the poor and needy. Have this in mind so that whenever you have to make a decision, you have this also. This is one of the cards on the table now. I just want you to make an informed decision, that's all. This is one of the pieces of information that will inform you in making your decisions. Okay? Alright. Now, I started with death. Look at how far we went from death. Let's come back to death. So I said death is overrated. Death is overrated because people believe this is the physical body breaking down is death. That death we needn't worry about, we needn't fear about, because as I said, it only lasts for a very short time, and then after that we don't know what's happened. But the fear of death lives with us forever. Throughout our lives we live with the fear of death. I mean that's quite ironical, isn't it? We live with the fear of death throughout our lives until we die. And then at the moment of death, we don't even know what it felt like, but we live with the fear of death. So even while we are alive, we live with the fear of death. That's pointless because you're not dead yet. But then when you die, you don't know what that felt like. So it just makes little sense. So how do we free ourselves from the fear of death? Not death, but the fear of death. To do so, we need to understand that death itself is a fabrication of the mind. Now, I'll refer you back again to the video that we watched last week. Those birds, the birds were flying in formation. As those birds started to take a different direction, the other birds, they followed suit. Yeah? And what you saw on screen, those shapes started to deform. If I were to ask you what happened to that particular shape, you would say that shape died. That shape came to a demise. It came to its death. That shape warped, or that shape distorted, and it came to a death. Because how we understand death is the no longer being of something, right? That is what we mean by death. For there to be death, ladies and gentlemen, there has to be something in existence. You are simply Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. These are the five aggregates. The five aggregates that have come together in this formation, in this configuration, and it stands now as is. This is why we call them living beings, in the present continuous tense. Remember? So right now, the five aggregates that you are made of, they are together. They take this particular shape. The thoughts that you have, the emotions that you have, the consciousness that you experience right now, all of this is just one bundle together. That's it. So when parts of it starts to disperse, it's not you dying. It's just that the building blocks that you are, that are put together, I'll bring you the set of building blocks next week to demonstrate this to you. The building blocks that you are together, this starts to disperse. And that's all it is. See, take this pen for instance. Right? This pen has a cap and a body. Okay? Now, when I take this cap off, you don't tell me that the pen is broken, do you? Why not? When I do that, you don't tell me the pen is broken. Yes, the pen can still serve its purpose. And you know that the pen, the cap can be replaced, right? It can be put back on the barrel. And you know that this is supposed to happen. We are supposed to be able to take it off and we can put it back again and the pen can serve its purpose. So you understand that this is simply a change in configuration. This being like this, and we take it out and we put it back, this is just a change in configuration. But if a part of your body came off, say this is your arm, this is your body, so this is your head, right? If this were to come off, right, that would be quite shocking. Of course, this part would not be able to serve its purpose anymore, and this would just drop dead. But you won't probably be able to put it back together again. And you feel that the body is now broken. See, here, you see this is simply as a change. These are two parts that are together in this moment. These two parts are now apart in this moment. Back together is together in this moment. And back apart, apart in this moment. But if a part of your body were to be taken out in the same way I do this, you feel that your body has broken. See, for things to break, you must feel that they are all part of the same unit. Otherwise, you don't perceive breaking. You don't think that this is broken because you know that these two are separate pieces that can be put together or taken apart. You don't feel that these two parts are the same part. You feel you know them to be two separate components. But if, say, this pen broke here, somewhere in the middle, part of the barrel and somewhere in here, then you would say it's broken. Because you know it's not supposed to come off that way. Then you'd say it's broken. Say this cap again were to split in half, then you'd say it's broken. So things break when in your mind they are one unit. I'll show you an example of something breaking. Let's take this betel leaf. See, this is not breaking, but this is, isn't it? Yeah? This is now broken. I will say it's torn, but just to keep it simple, it's broken. But the cap coming off, that's not breaking. Now, even if I were to put these two back together, like this, you'd still say these are the two parts of a broken leaf. Why do you think that this is broken when you didn't say the same about this? Because you feel that this whole thing is one unit. That's why. You fail to see that these are actually really what's going on here, ladies and gentlemen. You know, there are cells that make this leaf up, right? These cells, when I tore this leaf, between those cells there are bonds. So if this is the leaf, and so, right? So what I did was, I tore this in the middle. That's what I did. Okay? Now what you have is this part of the leaf, which has these cells, and this part of the leaf, which has these cells. They are now just separate. That's it. But as you see this whole thing as one leaf, you can't help but think now that the leaf is broken. So, what do you now think about the concept of breaking then? Do things really break? Or, when configurations change, do you perceive them as broken? You perceive things are broken. So, breaking is a perception. It's a perception that you create in your own mind. So, things don't really break. Does that make sense? Because I'm challenging things that you always known in life to be true. You know, right from our young formative years, right, we've always known things to break. Our toys broke, right? Our furniture broke, our cars broke, our houses broke, our things broke, all sorts of things broke. Your cutlery broke, your everything broke, right? And now I'm telling you that actually breaking is not something that really happens out there. It's just a creation of the mind. It's just an imagination of the mind. It's a delusion of the mind. So rather, it's an illusion of the mind. Because of delusion, you sense the illusion of breaking. What's really going on is when I tore them, these two parts, there were bonds that held these two layers of cells together. As I applied energy physically, that energy was enough to break the bonds between those two layers of cells. I'm sure there were lots of cells, clearly, but I'm just simplifying this, right? So when I applied energy, that was enough energy to break the bonds between these two, this border, so that the leaf is able to be torn. That's all that happened. Two lines of cells had bonds between each other, just as much as there are bonds between each of these layers, right? And those bonds broke, that's it. And now we have these two parts. But as you look at this, you tell me that this leaf is now broken. But here, when I do this, you don't tell me the pen is broken. Because you don't feel that these two are part of the same unit. Of course, it's the same unit that is the pen, but this is one component and here's another component. You are willing to accept that these two components are separable. Whereas this is one unit. Therefore, the concept of breaking you apply to this, but not to this. Now, take a part of your body. When a bone breaks, we call it a fracture. Yeah? So what happens when a bone breaks? Now, bones are calcium carbonate, mostly. So there are the calcium carbonate molecules that have bonds between each other, right? And when there's a fracture, the physical impact delivers enough energy for those bonds between those molecules to break, and therefore two parts disintegrate. The reason now you call it a broken bone is because you consider the whole bone to be one unit. What is a broken friendship then? Where is a broken friendship? What do you mean by a broken friendship? How are things broken? How do things break? Things break when in your mind, yes, when in your mind you perceive them as single units. So what's the big deal? Why are we interested in this? We're interested in this because when you attach yourself to these single units and then they break, what else breaks? Yes. What else breaks? Your heart breaks. So when you perceive the world as single units, right, that could be friendships, that could be relationships. See, just think about it for a second. When you're in a relationship with someone, you feel that there is something that keeps it, that, you know, the two of you, you feel like you are something, right? You feel like you're a couple. Where is that? That coupleness? Where is it? It's in the mind. Is it in the boy or is it in the girl? When you look at the boy alone, can you say that he's a couple? He's a member, he's part of a couple. If you look at the girl, can you say that she's part of a couple? No. When they are stood together, can you say that they're part of a couple? No, you still can't. What if they're standing in the, you know, waiting to get a bus? Unrelated. But say they're holding hands together now. Now you project, they must be a couple. Where did that come from? See, now you see the two of them as a unit. And you like that unit. If you like them to be together, you like that unit to be together, if they were to split up, now you'll say, the couple has split. They used to be a fine couple together, they were so much, you know, they were head over heels over each other, and now they've split up. What a shame, you'll say. That's a split couple. But where was the couple to begin with? They're just individual elements. But the coupleness was only in the mind. So as it's something just in the mind, if the mind attaches itself to that notion, if the mind attaches itself to that idea that this fabrication of a couple, right, if the mind begins to endure itself to it, now the mind begins to suffer when this one unit breaks. So you know, all these breakages, they're all mentally created. That is why people suffer. When the mind sees single units, the mind is creating a recipe for disaster. It's always doing that. To not do that, the mind needs to understand, and that is what we are trying to do with the Dhamma, to help the mind understand that these are not single units, but they're merely matter, energy, in a certain arrangement. Now, think about this for a second. When the Buddha returned to his hometown, it is said that Yashodhara was looking from her tower, and then she was very happy to see her husband, and she was very joyful about that. And then the little boy was there as well, Rahula. And then Prince Rahula went along. She said, "There's your father, right? Go and see him. Go and ask him for your inheritance." Little did she know what he was going to be given. So when the young prince went up to the Buddha and he held his hand, see, the young boy, that was Prince Rahula, would have felt that this is my father. And Yashodhara, the princess, the Queen Yashodhara by the time, would have felt that that is my husband, and that is my boy, right? So now we are family again. She probably have felt that. See, these were illusions that were both in the minds of Yashodhara and Rahula. But this illusion was not in the mind of the Buddha. He didn't see that it was his wife who was now waiting for his return. He didn't perceive that this was his son who's now holding his hand. He knows this though. He knows that biologically, this is my child. Biologically. That is his biology. Nothing emotional. He also knows that this young boy thinks that I am his father. He also knows that that lady over there thinks that I am her husband. Or at least her lay husband. He knows this. Because a Buddha knows how a non-Buddha mind thinks. Because it was one of those minds before he became a Buddha. But what the Buddha doesn't perceive at that time is that this is my wife and this is my child. The Buddha doesn't perceive it that way. The Buddha perceives Rupa, Vedana, Sanya, Sankara and Vijnana. And he gives it names. Rahula is Rahula. Even after his ordination, he was called Rahulhandru. And Yashodhara, you know, was still referred to as Yashodhara Devi. Later on called another name. Bhadrakachayana. But these are perceptions that the mind creates, and a mind that does not see fixed units, a mind that does not see single units, does not perceive it in this way, ladies and gentlemen. So the Buddha does not perceive that King Suddhodana is my father. He knows he is my father. But knowing that one is one's father and then feeling an emotional connection to them are very different things. One is knowledge. I don't know whether you're getting what I'm trying to get across to you, but I'll keep trying. Because in one way I'm saying he knows he's his father, then I'm saying he's not his father. Because what is it that makes one a father? It's a biological connection, isn't it? Now, say, take husband and wife. Is there any biological connection between the two of them? No. There is no biological connection whatsoever, right? So to sense that someone is a husband or a wife must be entirely mental, right? Agreed? It is mental, isn't it? Yes. It's entirely mental. It's a mental fabrication. But mother, father, there's a biological relationship there. So the Buddha understands that there's a biological relationship between him and his son, but there is no emotional connection there. Because the emotional connection of fatherly love towards a child, he no longer has. But that's not to say that he has no compassion towards his child, because remember, he's now one of these. what we drew on the board earlier, is now one of these. So to the Buddha, this is Rahula, this is somebody else, this is your child, this is your next door neighbor's child. To the Buddha, they're all the same. But here's something to consider. The Buddha looks at each one of them, and he with his superpowers, he's able to check who can quickly understand the Dhamma, who's going to be quicker at understanding the Dhamma. And let's say Rahula has more potential to understand the Dhamma before anybody else does. If that's the case, and the Buddha can only preach to one person at one time, given in that situation, the Buddha would start preaching to him. It wouldn't be right then for us to say, there you go, see, you say he doesn't have a special bond to his son, but now he's going and preaching to his son. That's not the case. Buddhas always tend to necessity. He understands that the necessity is here. As Rahula is going to be the first to understand the Dhamma, he will go to him and preach the Dhamma. Whereas if it was your child who has better ability, who is more capable of understanding the Dhamma, the Buddha would say, Rahula, can you stand aside for a second? I have somebody else I need to go and preach the Dhamma to. Then he would come and preach to your child first. Because he does not focus on me and my family and my circle. He does not have that. Because a mind that is free of raga, dvesha and moha does not have a self and anything that is also based on a self. All of these constructs that are based on a self, you know, the Buddha is free of, an arahant is free of. So therefore, vasudhaiva kutumbakam. All children are my children. And that is what we are. That is where we are trying to get to. Right now, if your children feel special to you, it's okay for the time being, but you need to understand that this is because of ignorance. You feel that your children are special to you. Now, what are the side effects of that? Don't you suffer as a result? You suffer as a result. So if you suffered because of every child, then that's a different matter. Right? No matter what happens to any child, I find myself suffering, so I'm in answer. The same, then that's a different kettle of fish. But if you suffer because of your child more than you suffer because of someone else's child, then you need to understand that there's a problem here. And that problem is the sense of self. And as you have this sense of self, you now have me, my children, my family, my friends, my circle, right? And that's how this suffering happens, starting from you and extends outwards. So, when you see single units and they break, now you think of death. Death is a notion that is created in the mind when you think that there's a living being who's now died. Really what's going on is there's a rupa, that is you, your body is just rupa, and the chittas are vedana, sanya, sankara and vijnana, right? There come a point where, based in this rupa, supported by this rupa, there can no longer be a vijnana. That's it. And when that happens, because the rupa can no longer support a vijnana, this vijnana can no longer arise in this rupa. And that is what we refer to as death. In fact, in Buddhist teaching, death is simply referred to as the separation of mind and body. So the chitta always arises and passes away. Whenever a chitta arises, it needs a rupa as its base. Without a rupa, there is no nama. So there's always going to have to be a rupa. And that rupa is currently this rupa that you have. It uses this as its base. But there's going to be a point at some point where this rupa can no longer sustain the vijnana, and therefore, from that point forward, the vijnana is not going to arise, and that is what death is. But we feel that this is the death of a living being. That is because we consider ourselves a single unit. We consider ourselves a being, and that is the cause of your suffering. That is why you fear death. So even if you have someone in the family who is maybe, you know, now very poorly, and they are coming to the end of their lives, right? Perhaps there's someone in the family like that, or maybe someone you know, right? And you're trying to help people to prepare themselves for it. Or maybe you're trying to, yourself, to try and prepare yourselves for it. This is the remedy for that. I'm not trying to actually prepare you for death. I'm trying to prepare you so that you understand that there is no such thing called death. So actually no one's died. No one is going to die, no one has died, and no one will die. Death is simply a creation of the mind. What's really going on is nama and rupa. There's a rupa and there's a nama. This nama continues to carry on, right? It takes an object, a sight object, and one cycle. Sound object, another cycle. Taste object, another cycle. On the same rupa. So there comes a point, this rupa can no longer sustain this process. So what happens then? This rupa disintegrates, another rupa arises, and then sight object, another cycle. Sound object, another cycle. That's it. So in one instance, you might call this a human. This configuration of rupa, we call a human. But there will have been lots of configurations of rupa that you would have seen along the way to the school today. You would have seen animals, dogs and cows and cats and all sorts. Right? They are all configurations of rupa. See, this is also a configuration of rupa. But you don't have nama in this. Because there isn't this configuration of rupa cannot sustain nama. That's why these things don't have chittas. That's why these things don't have consciousness. Because they can't sustain nama. But these bodies that you have, they can sustain the energy of nama. Therefore, on this base, that is your body, your physical body, that is a base. On that base, when an object arises, such as a sight or a sound or a smell, a chitta arises to perceive that. That's all you are. The perception of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch and thoughts on a base of rupa is all you are. So as I said one last time, this base that you are, this physical base that you are, will one day not be able to sustain this process. I'll quickly draw it on the board one last time. This is the body. Remember how the car was carring? Yes? The body is also what? It's bodying. Yeah? This is also in the present continuous. Okay? So there is not a fixed body here. Do you get that? There is no fixed body here. These are the causes that are constantly keeping it together. So there's energy that's keeping this body intact. Okay? So there's no fixed single unit of a body. On this base, there are chittas. These are chittas. These chittas arise when... So the body needs to support this process. You have sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. Sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, the body needs to support. That's why you have your sense organs. So sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, the body needs to support. And when a sight object, a smell object, a taste, touch object arrives through one of the sense doors, a chitta is born. There are some that don't require the body, and that is thought, or they're called Dhamma Rupa. They're just Dhamma Rupa. So that does not require body. Whether it requires a brain or not, we are still in two minds about it, but for the time being, let's just focus on this, on the left hand side, sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. So these two cycles are constantly in motion right now. So your existence is simply these two cycles in motion. So once again, please try and understand that you are not a fixed body. This is not an entity of a body. This body is a dynamic body. Energies are constantly in action that is keeping this body intact. So you are not a body, but you are bodying. That's because it's in the present continuous. Okay? And the chitta is the same. These chittas, they work so rapidly. Sometimes maybe a billion cycles of this in a matter of seconds. That's why you can almost perceive that, you know, things are so fluid. You're listening to the sermon and you're seeing the Swami Mahansa, you're feeling the coolness of the air, you're feeling the seat under your bottoms, you're feeling the flow under your seat, you're also feeling you're hungry right now. Now, all this is happening at the same time. It feels like it's all happening at the same time, but it's not. Because each chitta can only take one object at one moment. A chitta cannot take two objects at one moment. So in fact, when you're listening to me, you can't see me. Would you agree? It's almost difficult to agree with, isn't it? As you're seeing me, you're not hearing me. I know you're not hearing me. Excuse me. You're not listening to me. when you're looking at me. And then when you're listening to me, you're not looking at me. Right? And then when you're feeling the feet, the flow under your feet, you're doing neither of the above. And when you're feeling the coolness of the air, you're not doing any of the above, and so on. You can only do one thing at once. So multitasking is not so. There's no such thing called multitasking. A chitta cannot do two things at once. So these two cycles, they are currently in motion. Now, what is death? Before we get to death, if you don't, you know, people who don't understand this think that this is the being. They don't see this as nama and rupa. They think this is a being, a human being. So someone said this is Siripala. The whole thing is Siripala. Now, which part of Siripala is Siripala? Is it the body or is it the mind? Which part of Siripala is Siripala? If it's the body, then say Siripala, we do a heart transplant for Siripala. Now, whose heart is that? We get it from Sumanapala. Now, Siripala with Sumanapala's heart, is it? No. So you see, it's just a conventional name that we have used to identify a combination of matter. That's it. All of this is just elements of the periodic table. But we call it a pen because in this configuration, it is able to do something. It is able to serve a purpose. And that purpose we refer to as a pen. Not necessarily the shape or the object. We refer to that purpose as a pen. Because if this couldn't write, we wouldn't call it a pen, would we? We wouldn't call it a pen. So the ability to write is what we call a pen. Okay? So what is death then? The Buddhist teaching of death is where the body being no longer able to support this. So this cycle, it ceases. That cycle ceases. When that cycle ceases, ladies and gentlemen, this cycle can no longer run because it always needs a body as a base. Once again, this cycle always needs a body as a base. Now the base is gone. This base has disintegrated. But it needs another base. So because it needs another base, it has enough energy, the chitta has enough energy in the karma to create another base for itself. So this is how, if you are human today, you can die and be born as a deva or a brahma or even as an animal. Because it depends on what karma you've done. So when the next time it comes to the fruition of that karma, depending on what that karma is, another base will be created. Another base will be formed. And that base will be dependent on what the karma that was done by the chitta. Remember, this is not one chitta. I'm drawing a cycle here. Right? Each chitta is a unique chitta. It's never arisen before and it will never arise again. See how unique you are? You are not just unique in your lifetime. You are unique in every chitta cycle. You are unique in every chitta cycle. So this chitta that you have now, it has never risen before and it never will rise again. That's how unique you are. These are simply chittas after chittas after chittas after chittas. That's all that's going on inside of you. But you still feel that it is I who exists. See, although these are individual chittas that arise and pass away, you feel that there is something persistent here. You feel that there is something constant here, don't you? That is the self that you identify with. That is what you feel is constant. I've always been here. How can this be rising and passing away? How can I be so unique? You understand the level of uniqueness. You understand that you are unique to somebody else. That you understand. But if you can identify that you are just a chitta, then you've never been here before. You will never be here again. You are not the you that was here a second ago. And you are not the you that will be here in another second's time. You have never been and you never will be. You are what you are right now. That's it. That's how unique you are. Because these are all cycles. These cycles are constantly arising and passing away. The body is busy bodying and the chitta is busy chittaing. These are arising and passing away constantly. So whatever causes keep a chitta arise, then for as long as those causes are there, a chitta arises. For as long as there are causes to keep a body in motion, there's a body that manifests. These are both manifestations. Okay? So these are both manifestations. This is what I mean by a manifestation. There are causes that keep the body, this body process and the chitta process. These are both processes. So there are two main processes that run inside these bundles. The body process and the chitta process. These are the two processes that are constantly running. Now, every time one of these chitta processes run, if there's ignorance and attachment, it creates karma. It creates karma. And that karma is what gives rise to this vipaka, as vipaka. That karma is what gives rise to this as vipaka. And that karma is also what gives rise to another chitta. So the sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, these are all vipakas of karmas. So don't you see a self-sufficient machine here? It keeps itself in motion. Ignorance and attachment is all you need. You recharge your own cells. So every time one of these runs, as long as there's ignorance and attachment, there's enough karma to create a body. There's enough karma to create sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. And so these two cycles are constantly kept running, all because of ignorance and attachment. Because out of ignorance and attachment you have bhava and jati. Bhava is the energy that goes on to create karma. Now what happens ultimately at the point of death? This body, the physical body, can no longer sustain itself, right? Because it's now old, like the cells are now, you know, not like it used to be, the muscles are not like it used to be, the tissues are not like it used to be, and they can't sustain this It can't keep itself intact, right? So then what happens is, this disintegrates because it can't any longer sustain this process, but the next patisandhi karma comes along and it creates another body. It creates another body. And that body will take the shape of the karma, whatever the karma was. So if that karma was a good karma, wholesome karma, then the body will be of a wholesome nature. If the karma was an unwholesome karma, then the body will take the shape of an unwholesome karma or unwholesome vipaka. And that is how it is determined where you are born. If it's a wholesome karma, then you can be born either as a human or a deva or a brahma. And if it's an unwholesome karma, then it's the chitta ultimately that decides all of this. If it's an unwholesome karma, then this new instance of body will be in the four great hells, or it could be a preta, it could be an animal, right, and so on. But once again, as soon as the body arises, now the chitta cycle keeps running again. So this will keep on running for as long as ignorance exists. Ignorance is the secret recipe here, because ignorance is what tells the chitta that pleasure can be obtained at any moment now. So therefore, the chitta constantly keeps on looking for sight, sound, smell, taste and touch in the hope that happiness can be found in them. So believing that happiness can be obtained from the sight, sound, smell, taste and touch that comes from it from the outside world, it keeps on this quest to continuously keep looking for happiness from the outside world. So this is why I'm trying to explain to you that happiness does not come from the outside world. Once you realize that happiness doesn't come from the outside world, now you no longer need sight, sound, smell, taste and touch. If you no longer need sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, then you no longer need a body. Do you? If you don't need sights, why do you need eyes? If you don't need sounds, why do you need ears? If you don't need smell, why do you need a nose? If you don't need taste, why do you need a tongue? If you don't need touch, why do you need a body? So if you don't need these five senses, or these five sense stimuli, then you don't need the physical body at all. Then why do you need them? Because you believe that they have pleasure, that they bring you pleasure. That's why you try to eat a bar of chocolate, expecting it to make you happy. Because in that taste of chocolate, you believe you can be pleased. You believe you can find happiness in a taste of chocolate. So therefore you take the bar of chocolate and you start munching on it. So the sight of chocolate makes you happy. The smell of chocolate makes you happy. The taste of chocolate makes you happy. All the while you're generating karma as you're eating your chocolate, right? Because you like your chocolate. So all the while you're generating karma, and this karma goes up here to create a new body that can come back and give you the sense of smell, taste, touch and so on. And you keep on doing that. Once again, for as long as you believe that a chocolate can give you pleasure, your chitta, your mind, will want the smell of chocolate, the sight of chocolate, the taste of chocolate, the feel of chocolate. Yeah? For as long as you believe chocolate gives you pleasure, you will want it. Why do you think it will give you pleasure? That is ignorance. Then why do I preach the Dhamma to you? Exactly. To free you from ignorance. That is why the Dhamma is the only remedy to death. This is where we started the sermon. So for as long as you are ignorant and you believe that chocolate brings you pleasure, Your mind will always want a pair of eyes so you can see chocolate. Your mind will want a tongue so you can taste chocolate. Your mind will want a nose so you can smell chocolate. Your mind will want a body so you can feel chocolate. You will want to experience chocolate. Every time you do that, you are generating karma. That karma is responsible for creating a body. That body is there, you know, this is really your demand, your order. You're making, you're creating, you're placing an order. Can I have a body, please? Why? To experience my chocolate, that's why. You're placing an order for, can I have a pair of eyes, please? That's what this karma does. Can I have a tongue, please? Can I have a nose, please? You're placing these orders. And then when this body comes to its end, these karmas create another one for you. So that you can continue to be satisfied, or at least you think you're satisfied. So another body is formed with a pair of eyes, nose, tongue and body, so you can keep on eating your chocolate, ever hoping that it will make you happy. But unfortunately, chocolate never made you happy, because happiness is not in chocolate. But for as long as you believe it is in the chocolate, you will constantly keep on generating these karmas, and then these karmas will bring you this blessing of a body. When did you last time ever ask for a backache? Did you place an order for a backache? How about a toothache? Headache? Diarrhea? Corona? Flu? Runny nose? Asthma? Nothing, right? No. What did you place the order for? Eyes, nose, tongue, body. Well, guess what? You didn't read the small print when you signed the contract. You only asked for the Ashvada, but you also get the Adina. It comes as a package. You only wanted the daughter, but she comes with the in-laws, right? That's the same deal everywhere. You can't get away with just what you want. It comes as a package. So whenever you keep on asking, whenever you keep on placing these orders for sights and sounds and smells, or rather for eyes, ears, nose and tongue, you will get what you ask for, and then some. But no, here's the ugliest part of this deal, ladies and gentlemen. All this is because of ignorance. Chocolate you've never experienced the deliciousness of chocolate, because chocolate itself is not delicious. There is no pleasure to be had in chocolate. Pleasure can only be experienced through relief from vexation. It is not in chocolate. Pleasure is not in cake. Pleasure is not in ice cream. Pleasure is not in anything out there. It's simply to be experienced when the mind relieves from vexation. But that is what ignorance is. Ignorance hides all this from you, so that you can blissfully carry on placing your orders for another body and another existence, and you just keep on going through in samsara. And the punishment that you have to endure as a result of placing those orders. This is the tax that you have to pay. Your headaches, your backaches, your heartaches, your kidney failures, your cancers, all of this is the tax that you have to levy for making such a foolish demand, such a foolish order. For every time you suffer physically, remind yourself that it's because of this foolishness that we keep on doing this. So come out of ignorance. That is why we preach the Dhamma. See, there is nowhere else I can help you break free, is there? I can't go and wash away all your karma. The karma is already done. I can't wash it all away for you. I can't undo your karma. It's all done. All I can do is help you to understand that ignorance is the problem here. You're covered by behind a veil of ignorance. If we can replace this with wisdom, what happens then? If we replace this with wisdom, now the mind understands that pleasure is not to be found in sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. So, when this body once again disintegrates, when this body breaks, the citta no longer wants sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, because it does not, it understands that pleasure does not come from there. It is now content. It does not seek happiness from outside. So if it does not seek sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, it does not need eyes, ears, nose, tongue or body. Therefore, if it doesn't need an eyes, ears, tongue or body, therefore, although there is this karma already done, it has no need for that karma anymore. It's like money you have earned. This is like money you have earned. But what if you don't need to buy the things that money can buy you? Now you have no longer any need for that money, is there? That's the way karma works, sir.
Well,
you
touch the nose, it plays a part in the five senses.
Hmm. Sorry, ask the question again.
So, if the arahant understands that he doesn't need the five senses, he doesn't need the body, so why he needs another body when he's moving forward? He can just energy.
That's what happens.
So actually, I cannot see arahant, just energy.
Ah, no, I see. So, once you become an arahant, while you are still human, the body that was once produced remains. Because, you know, when a body is produced, there's an amount of energy. It's like filling up your car, right, with fuel. The fuel that you have put into your vehicle is there until you run out. Yeah? So when one pratisandhi karma comes along and creates a body, that body has enough energy within it to sustain a while. So that might be 50 years, might be 10 years for some people, might be 100 years for others. So whilst a human being becomes an arahant within that own body, there is no need now for another body. So when this body has served its purpose, and when this body disperses, as I prefer not to use the word dies, because death is a mental fabrication. When this body disperses, now the citta no longer places an order for another body. So therefore, because there's no need for a citta anymore either. Yeah? You only need a body if the citta has to continue to exist. So like this is the driver, here's the vehicle. If you don't want to drive, why do you need a vehicle? Make sense? So, you want to drive because you want to go places. If you have nowhere you want to go, then you don't want to drive. You don't need to drive. If you don't need to drive, now you don't need a vehicle. See the connection? Yeah? So, wanting to go places is like wanting to see the sights, to hear the sounds, to have the taste, to have the pleasure from the physical sensations. But the body that you were born with, that's there. This is the body that you were born in. So you got the car that you, when you first came in with. But now you have lost your interest in going places. Therefore you no longer travel. But the car is still at home. Like say, you know, maybe if, when your parents, you know, they get older, they probably have the old banger at home. The car is still at home probably. But nobody's using it anymore. They don't go and buy another car, but that car that they had, maybe that's still at home. It's very old now. They don't use it anymore, but it's still there. One day when the parents are gone, if you can sell it off or something, you will. Otherwise, you know, it will get taken to the scrapyard. That's exactly what happens. Sir?
What about the contemplation?
Yeah. Okay. That's what I said about, like, the money that you've earned. You know, when you earn money, you earn money because you want to spend it. You want to spend your money because you want to buy things. So this is another analogy. Okay? So because you want to buy things, you earn money. You earn money so you can spend money and then buy things. If you don't want to buy anything, then there's no point in earning any more money. But the money that you have already earned, it's there. But if you have no more use for it, this is energy that was separated. This is the concept of separation we've been talking about. This is the karma, the energy, pure energy that was separated and segregated by the mind because it had a grasp on it. So the chitta, the mind, had kept a close grasp on that energy, this karmic energy. Where the point, that's why they call raga, dvesha and moha, they're called bonds. The bond of raga, the bond of dvesha and the bond of moha. So these bonds keep this karma connected to the chitta. Okay? That's why your karma does not affect somebody else. Because that karma is like a funnel. It's connected to you. But when the chitta, by freeing itself of ignorance and becoming wise and taking, you know, through wisdom, now severs these bonds, raga, dvesha and moha, this energy is no longer my energy. See, the concept of self and my, it goes everywhere. It prevails everywhere. Even to karma. It becomes my karma. So when raga, dvesha and moha bonds are severed, this energy now just is released and it just becomes pure energy. That energy is then released to go and form whatever else in this universe. But for as long as raga, dvesha and moha exist in the mind, this energy is trapped. And that becomes your karmic energy. That is why that energy keeps coming back to you. So once you become a sotapanna, there may be karmas here that will bring you birth in the four great hells. For now, maybe there are karmas that bring you birth in the four great hells. So you've heard that the Buddha said, someone becomes a sotapanna, they're freed from the four great hells once and for all, right? So what happens then is as the mind becomes wise, it lets go of three of the cankers. Sakkaya ditthi vichikicca and silabbada paramasa. In other words, that is to sever some portion of the bonds that keep it connected to this karmic cell. And the degree to which it can let go, the karma that was here that was going to bring rebirth in the four great hells, that is now released. It is released as pure energy. So therefore, the energy that was in here to bring you rebirth in the four great hells as an animal, as a preta, or as a demon, right? Or maybe in the aviti. That karma is now released. So actually, you trap your own karma. And that is what brings you rebirth in the four great hells, in the human worlds, in the deva worlds, in the brahma worlds, and so on. Because you, the energy to create your own bodies, your mind has created, and it keeps it trapped. So once the raga, dvesha and moha start to diminish, that energy is now released. So that's not to say that that energy now goes and creates an animal body for somebody else. It's just pure energy now. Pure energy does not have any particular shape. It's just pure energy. That pure energy can go into making something else depending on how a chitta interacts with it. That's a discussion for another day. But essentially what I want you to understand is, this is the only remedy, understanding the Dhamma. See, now do you see why I explained to you earlier, purity of intention and purity of the receiving party is what brings you the most merits. See, this truth applies to everyone universally, right? Whether you are a Christian, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Buddhist, animals, whatever. This truth applies to all. The reason why people, beings, suffer is all contained here. It is the citta that creates its own suffering. You create your own suffering. Nobody else creates your suffering for you. If you are going to be born as an animal in a future birth, it's all because of your own doing. But you can change all that now. You don't have to suffer just because you did a bad deed in your, maybe, you know, 10 years ago. Maybe 10 years ago you stole something from someone. Maybe you killed someone. Just because that was done 10 years ago doesn't mean you have to suffer. Because if you understand the Dhamma, these bonds that keep it tied to the citta, if you can only sever those bonds, that's it. This energy that was all entrapped in there, that gets released. For that energy to be released, you need to let go of the notion of self. Because for as long as you hold on to this notion of self, this becomes your karma. Because where there is me, there is my. If this is me, then this is my karma. If it's my karma, then that karma is always going to be with you. Let go of me, and the mind will be let go of. That's the way it works. I know there was a lot to take on for one Sunday morning, but we will discuss that again another day. And if it made sense to you, then you've done really well. If some of it made sense to you, then you've still done well. If it didn't make sense to you, if it only made very little sense to you, that's okay. We'll discuss it again another day. And it'll eventually make sense to all. But don't forget, as many merits as you possibly can, and keep practicing the Dhamma as best you can. These two things is all I ask you to do. Do as much merits as you can, and practice the Dhamma as much as you can. Okay, let's conclude for today then, and transfer the merits. First and foremost, let us remind ourselves how incredibly fortunate we are to be in receipt of the Lord Buddha's teaching, and with immense gratitude, let us take a moment to transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who since time immemorial have protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to all members of the Mahasangha present throughout the world, including the chief prelates of all of the chapters who dedicated their lives to the noble path and have committed themselves towards the betterment of all sentient beings. Let us also transfer these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. Let us also transfer these merits to my teacher Guru Swami Nuhanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarika and Anagarika communities attached to the monastery. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great efforts to disseminate the teachings of the Buddha, be that by transliterating these talks, sharing them out with others, or inviting others to join them. Let us also transfer these merits to the friends of the monastery, to our devotees, who, for the sake of merits to help them attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana, continue to provide towards the construction of the monastery, to those as well as to providing the four requisites to the monks and to help with their practice, as well as those who extend their well wishes and continue to pass on their know-how. May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to our mothers and fathers, husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintances, our employers, our employees and our teachers, as well as those who have helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form May they all rejoice in these merits. By the power of these merits, may they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the devas and brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the numerous gods and deities who commit themselves towards fulfilling and preserving the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who have passed away in our name. Our forefathers, our ancestors, those who have shed blood, sweat and tears on our behalf, and thanks to whom today we are able to practice the Dhamma in peace and harmony. May they all rejoice in these merits. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to those who make great sacrifices and sacrifice their lives on behalf of all of us to protect the peace and harmony of our nation. This includes members of the armed forces as well as the police force. Let us also transfer merits to those who have lost their lives in the war, be they friend or foe, as well as those who have lost their lives to natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, blizzards, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been mothers and fathers to us, brothers and sisters to us, friends and acquaintances to us. They will have gone every distance to help make our lives better and support us in every single way. Out of compassion and loving kindness towards all of them, let us transfer all these merits that we have acquired to them. May they all rejoice in these merits, and if any of them have been born in the woeful plains, they redeem themselves to be born in the blissful plane. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And may you and I and everyone who has made this program a success become a Rahatan Vahanse or an Arahataranin Vahanse in this very life itself and in the era of the Gautama Supreme Buddha itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. And the members of the Mahasangha will transfer their blessings to you now. Raga ginnan nidatnva Dvesha ginnan nidatnva Moha ginnan nidatnva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatna Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satnvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatna Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravatna Raga gini niveva Dvesha gini niveva Moha gini niveva Nivan Sapalameva Nivan Sapalameva
තුන්වන්ගේ සුවිසි අනන්ත මහා ගුණ බලෙන් සියලු ලෝක සියලු සත්වයෝම නිබ්බාන පරම සුඛයෙන් සුඛිතතර වෙත්වා. සාදු සාදු සාදු.